Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Chrissy Goldrick, and this is Talking Australia, a podcast from Australian Geographic. Today I'm talking to Nick Gleeson. Nick is a truly adventurous spirit. He's climbed to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, climbed above Everest Base Camp. He's run the New York Marathon 3 times. He's carried the Olympic torch. He's represented his state of Victoria in cricket. And the list goes on and on and on. But what makes Nick truly remarkable is that he's been totally blind since the age of 7. So I'm really excited to be sitting down with Nick Gleeson on this episode of Talking Australia. Welcome to Talking Australia, Nick Gleeson.
Thank you very much, Chrissy. It's a pleasure to be here.
And welcome to Unity. Unity is your seeing eye dog. So this is our first ever Australian Geographic dog cast.
That's right. Exactly.
And Unity is a beautiful golden retriever dog who's sitting with us here in the Australian Geographic stationery cupboard. And so we're all here together this morning, and it's just great to see you, Nick.
You've
led an extraordinary life. There's just never really been a dull moment. Where does it come from? Where do you get this drive, this zest for life that would leave most people standing?
Do you know, I think it may stem way back to my childhood, and I've thought about this, especially as I've got older, where do I get the motivation to want to find the next thing to do in life? And I keep going back to when I became blind at the very young age, and the encouragement that was shown to me by my parents and the teachers at that time. I think they were the real key people that got me motivated to believe that I could do what I really wanted to do in life and to give it a go. So I think that's where it started from.
Now, those people that you spoke about before, both your teachers and your parents, tell us a little bit, take us back actually to that time when you lost your sight, or even to your childhood down in Victoria. Tell us actually how that happened, because you did see up until the age of 7, but then you lost your sight in an accident.
Yeah, I remember very clearly those particular days, and it all started on a Thursday, late Thursday afternoon, and I was with my mother in a supermarket, and we lived in Broadmeadows, just a suburb in Melbourne, a very much working class suburb, and we were about to leave the supermarket, and I was either walking or running, and I stood on the mat that triggered the electronic door, and it was a swinging door rather than sliding, and it hit me on the side of the head and caused a bit of blood and a few tears, but my mum and the shop assistant, they cleaned it up, and we went home and we thought nothing more of it. But then at about 1 p.m. on the Sunday afternoon, suddenly I could only see half of everything. And my parents drove me into the hospital, into the eye hospital. And I recall vividly sitting in the car, looking out the window, wondering why the buildings were getting blurred and further away. And I looked up into my mother's face, and that would be the last image I would ever see. And I remember she hugged me, and we arrived at the hospital. But I couldn't see, they operated, but nothing could be done. So I started on my pathway of being blind. So that was my first, I suppose, the beginning of a new way of seeing and adjusting to a new situation. And that's what I often say to people is in life we are often faced with adjustments, things that we don't particularly like, but we don't have much control over. And I know I always say to people, no, it's very wise to feel the loss. Sometimes you have to experience the grief of the loss, and then, but be very much aware of, you have to move on at some point in time.
And your mother, your parents, had obviously laid a lot of the groundwork for the way in which you were going to deal with this great kind of tragedy that affected your life from the age of 7 onwards. Tell us a little bit about your mum and dad.
Yeah, again, they were just very ordinary people. I say that in the nicest way, but they had no counselling when it came to what would help me as a young boy who was blind. So they did it very naturally. And my dad, he was a builder's labourer, and my mum had quite a lot of health issues, but she was very special in that she was very proud of her family. She was very house proud, so her home was, she kept it very clean and orderly, and was in many ways a tremendous role model. My dad, on the other side, was wonderful, very loving and caring, but he did have some, I suppose, generational challenges as far as his work often meant that the men went for beer after work. At times he had alcohol issues. There was never any violence in our family at all. However, alcohol was a bit of a challenge for him at times. And when I look back too, I can understand it. I think a lot of people would have resorted to alcohol looking at what he had gone through. But he continued to be a loving, caring person. And to his credit, in the last 8 years of his life, he gave away alcohol totally, yeah, which was a great thing.
Mm.
But as far as assisting me, my dad was very creative. Say, for instance, I loved AFL and still do, and I love sport. But my dad would put bells inside a football. So I realised then, yes, I can't see, but I can still play football in the backyard with my dad and my brothers, and we'd kick the ball around. I could still take, you know, the flukish mark. So somehow the ball would just by luck would fall in my arms. But that special moment was my moment.
Mm.
And I often recall and share the story of my dad taking myself and my older brother down to Cardinia Park, the home ground for Geelong AFL team, and arriving there as a young boy of 8 by then, and what it was like. And some people say, well, why would a totally blind person go to a football game? And the reason is that we arrived there and I could smell the meat pies and sauce.
Mm.
I could hear the young boys with the football record, the little booklet they'd be selling, and they'd be calling out. I could hear people walking and giving the come on Geelong, and the whole atmosphere, and the jam donuts and sugar. I could smell that. And just finding our seats and sitting there with my little transistor, listening to the game. And I remember on that particular day at halftime, my dad somehow talking our way into the football, the players' room, and meeting the champion Geelong football players of that period. And one of the players picked me up above his head, and smelling the deep heat that they were rubbing into their bodies at that time, and hearing the coach's message to them, and some of the words he was saying were probably not for 8-year-old ears to hear, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter. And I remember going back in outside into our seats and Geelong winning the game, going home with that seed of belief that I could be a champion, I could do the things. I just met the people who motivated me to get on with my life.
How wonderful. What a great sort of story. And that's like within about a year or so of you losing your sight, you're already developing all these other senses where you experience the world through those the smells and the sounds and things. And I know that this is the way in which you were then able to sort of start participating in sport, like as you talked about. There's special equipment involved, but there's also just that way in which you, you know, learn to sort of have the courage, I suppose, to put one foot in front of the other when you can't see. And that really, that sounds like your father had a huge role in that, in encouraging you to do that. But also your large family, you're one of seven. So I imagine it's a big knockabout family with lots of people around all the time that probably, you know, you just sort of had to get on with it.
In many ways it was, however, My family, like a lot of other families, my mother, her first husband left her, and they had three children, of which one half brother I didn't see until I was 21, and a sister, she'd passed away due to cot death, and then another brother of mine died in a tragic accident when he was 23. Mm. So there's a lot of things happening within our family.
Yeah,
and that's why I often say to people that you can go through periods of real challenges. And both my parents died by the time I was 21. But my message is never give up. No, you always hang in there, and despite the gloom and the doom that often appears at that moment, there is blue sky ahead.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just a matter of just getting through the next hour, doing something nice for yourself, try to get through to the next day, and look for the resources that are around. There's a friend or someone, a counsellor, or all you have to do, in my mind, is just keep pushing forward and meeting those people. And my family were an incredible family, and they did encourage me, but they didn't overanalyze everything either. It just came naturally. Mm. And they didn't say, sit me down and say, Nick, you've got to show courage, or you've got to put goals in place. And that happened really quite naturally and with enjoyment.
And with love.
And that's right, with love as well.
Yeah. Now, you talked about your teachers. So you went off to boarding school quite early on as well. And that was a blind boarding school for the blind. At what age did you go off and do that?
Straight away. Yeah.
Right.
Straight after I lose my sight, I went to St. Paul's School for the Blind in Kew.
Mm.
And that was a very good school. And it was quite unique in the sense that they had a boys' house and a girls' house, and they were old Victorian houses, so dating back to probably built in like the 1860s and 70s. And even the school itself, where we had our lessons, that was an old building. So it had that homely feeling to it. And the staff were very good overall. They were just amazing people that showed care but discipline as well. And I remember the matron of the school, and this probably would not happen these days, but she said to my parents, she said, your son will be treated like any other member of a family. And if he comes home and says he's got a smack for being naughty, believe him.
And were you ever naughty at school, Nick?
I don't think I got a smack, but it was a good heads up straight away.
Yeah. You knew where you stood anyway.
I knew where I stood. Yeah. And she was amazing. And, you know, in the morning she would say, boys, everyone outside before breakfast. Don't just sit down and so she encouraged us to get outside and almost she sort of forgot about being blind.
Mm.
You know, she'd say, go and play ball or go and do this or, you know. And so it didn't really feel like, a traditional boarding school in that sense. It felt like an extended family.
Mm.
And of course, we got away as much as we could, and the staff caught us as much as possible as well.
And that's where you started playing footy, is that?
Yeah, we played football there. We'd put bells and ball, which created teams and competitions. I was always very competitive. Mm. So I think, you know, when I look back, I think I probably put some boys through a lot of hell because I was the one bossing them around saying, yeah, we're going to play ball and you're on this team and I'm on this team and now we're going to do this and do that. And I loved, we played cricket and I also share the story of listening to the England versus Australia Ashes series, and that would, by memory, it was 1972, so I was about 11 years of age, and it was played in England, so it was on throughout the night, so I had my transistor under my pillow, and the nurses would come around and check on the boys, make sure they're all sleeping and all doing well, and one of the nurses heard my transistor, so she confiscated it. And she said, you won't return this until Friday. You'll get this back on Friday when you go home. And I did pretend to be very devastated, but little did she know I had a backup transistor. I wasn't going to miss out on listening to the test match in England.
Oh, how wonderful, how wonderful. But so you played cricket, you excelled at cricket as well as at footy, but you ended up playing to represent Victoria. Tell us about the blind cricket game. How does that work in terms of taking those catches? And
I love blind cricket. You know, firstly, the team is combined of players who are either totally blind like myself, and often you'd have, say, four who are totally blind, and the rest of the team would be made up of those who are legally blind, often referred to as vision impaired or have low vision. So they can see, they ordinarily wouldn't use a cane or a dog. Mm-hmm. The ball has bells inside it, and you bowl, and I often say, in true Trevor Chappell style, underarm. And that's all legal, it's underarm. And the rule is the ball must touch the pitch once before the halfway line and once after. Mm. And when I bat, I would have one of my teammates who has low vision or vision impairment, and he would run for me.
Right.
And the bowler would ask, are you ready? And I'd say, yes. And as the ball has been delivered, the bowler would say, play. So you knew the ball was on its way, and then you'd be listening for the bells, and then also your runner would do his best to say, straight, off, leg. But I learnt very early in my career, listen to them, but don't necessarily believe them. Because I remember one of my first innings is he said, leg. So I took a big swing down leg side and boom, bowled middle stump. That's like, what happened?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, it must be in the wind. And I said, yeah, but no, there's no wind. So it's a bit of a lesson in life, isn't it? When it comes to it, we are responsible for our own doing, and we can rely on others, but not totally. Mm-hmm. We have to take some responsibility, and that's what I learned in cricket. And cricket did teach me a lot about being a good sport. I think initially I'd get really upset when we lost. And then I realised, you know what, the best thing for me to do is to go and shake the hand of the opposition players. And that helped me to manage the loss. And it also motivated me to, next time we're going to win. So I don't want to go and shake the hands every time. I want to be the one receiving the victory handshake.
Well, and you did go on, and you've played a lot of cricket at a very high level, and undoubtedly a very good team sports player. But you've also been you became a runner. Solo runner, you know, a runner of marathons, but also a runner of fast races.
Yeah.
What's the training for you in running a sprint?
Well, I did my sprinting when I was in my teens, the later teens through to around about the age of 26. And I absolutely loved the 100 sprint. That was my favourite event, mainly because you ran that independently. So it was a time trial.
Oh, I see. So you don't have the other runners lined up next to you. You just run against the clock.
And you didn't run with anyone else.
Right.
So you had no guide.
Mm.
All you did was run to your coach's voice. So in an event, it would only be myself on the blocks, and my coach standing behind the finish line, and then the timekeepers. And that sense of absolute freedom of, and the thrill, I suppose, the element of a bit of danger. And as a young person, often, you know, we throw that caution to the wind, and literally I'd be sprinting to her voice, and that total sense of freedom, of no restraints. Even though I'm totally blind, I am going maximum speed for 100 metres. And I think that's what I loved most about my competitive running. And I mean, I of course I wanted to win, but for me it was more around that sense of freedom.
Exhilaration.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, that was solo running against the clock, and then you started marathon running, and you've ended up running the New York Marathon, which has got tens of thousands of people around you. How did you negotiate something like that?
Well, what happened was, and again, I think it's a bit of a lesson of sometimes we, to achieve your bigger goal, you put little steps into place. And that was, I joined a club called the Achilles Running Club. And that was in Sydney, the first one of the first chapters of that worldwide club in Australia. And when I turned up, they said, oh, you know, we can enter you in a 10-kilometre race. And I thought, oh, what? 10 kilometres? I'm used to running 1, 2, 400s, that's all. But no, I started to adapt and I started training for longer distances, and I ran the 10K, and then they said, we've entered you in the Sydney Half Marathon, which is 21K. And then they came along and said, well, we've got 7 airline tickets, of which 3 people who are blind, including yourself, and we're going to New York. And we had 3 fantastic guides, as well as a famous former Olympic champion, Lisa Ondieki. And she was, she'd won the New York Marathon. And so on our first marathon, we were travelling to New York. Wow. And I'll always remember that, standing on the start line in Staten Island with 42 kilometres in front of me. And as you say, tens of thousands of people. And that sense of excitement mixed with fear and doubts and determination. And running through all the different boroughs of New York and a marathon, I tell so many people, a marathon can be achieved by absolutely anyone. Anyone can do it. It's just a matter of deciding to do it and then putting the steps into place. So I loved it. And when I finished my first marathon and crossed that finish line, that feeling of achievement was so wonderful, and the atmosphere is so fantastic that I had to go back 2 more times and have the same feeling.
And then just run up the Empire State Building for kicks, hey?
Well, that was so funny because it was straight after my first New York Marathon, and I was invited 3 months later to come back to do an event that's held annually and to run up the 1,576 steps. And I often say to people, well, the good news is you can take the lift down. But I remember that event mainly because of someone else who participated. And that was a man who was interviewed straight after he finished. And he was an 80-year-old man. Yes. And his words went something like, I have just finished my 20th annual medical checkup. And thank you for the opportunity to participate again. And I thought, what a fantastic advertisement for people who are older now in our community.
Yeah, it's a great idea. That and what, when you're running up, are you just on your own? Do you have a person that's like next to you that hold on to, or do you?
No. I ran by myself. I had a person who followed me, and he would yell out things like, person coming up, and I could usually hear their footsteps anyhow. And it was an interesting event in that they made me start exactly last, about 30 seconds after everyone else had gone. But in those days, I was extremely fit. So I ended up passing about 100 people by the time we got to the top, and which we didn't really factor into it because we thought I would be that far behind, that wouldn't be an issue. Mm-hmm. But the people were fantastic, and I would hear them, and then what would happen, my guide would call out, a blind runner coming up, and then I would lightly touch them on the back, and then they would either stop or I would manoeuvre my way around them and then find the rail again, and then my challenge was to meet the next person. So it became a bit of a game for me, like, where's the next one?
We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. We have a special offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you'll receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all our products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Obviously, a very fit and a finely tuned athlete is what you became. Yeah. And then at some stage, you sort of started exploring the idea of a true adventure and sort of leaving these kind of sporting areas and taking all of that determination and applying it to adventures in the great outdoors. And I first met you back in 2002 when you were our Spirit of Adventure Award winner that year for climbing Mount Kilimanjaro.
That's right.
And we haven't really caught up with each other much in the intervening years, but you've had some incredible adventures in that time, and including in very, very recent times. So first of all, tell us about Kilimanjaro. That was an organisation known as Blind Ambition that you did.
That's
I think
right.
You set that organisation up. So tell us, take us right back to then when you were just a young man and I was just a young woman, and it was quite a long time ago. Was that your first mountain, the first mountain that you attempted to climb?
Yeah, that's right. And again, I think when I look back, that goal, I believe, stemmed right back to my childhood before I lost my sight, watching a black and white television, seeing Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, and almost like subconsciously that seed was planted and then resurfaced all those years ago. And it took a fair bit of planning, because I wanted to feel what high altitude felt like, but I had no idea how to go about doing it. So it took many phone calls and different discussions and conversations with lots of people before I found a person called Lucas Trahi, who lives in the Blue Mountains. And Lucas would change my life, because he understood and sat down with me and said, this is what we could do. He said, what are your goals? What do you actually want to experience? And I said, well, you know, I want to reach hopefully as a summit, but that's not my primary goal. I do want to feel what it's like when people struggle in high altitude, what it's like to be breathless and to really have to push through a bit of pain and maybe a bit of struggle. But I'm not an experienced climber as such. He said, well, I think Kilimanjaro would be the perfect mountain. And then he said, well, who do you want to climb with? And I said, well, I'd love to have some close friends, but I don't want it to be too big a group, because I want it to remain intimate. I want it to remain something that we can share as one. And he said, well, I think five would be a good number. And we just discussed about the environment, because I wanted to be able to understand what the vegetation was like and the actual mountain itself, not just walk past it all, because when you're blind, you don't see it. So you want it described. You want to be able to stop and feel the leaves. You want to feel the soil, feel the wind, the sun, and all the other aspects of the experience. And that's what Lucas ensured happened. And that's what we formed Blind Ambition 1. And I had a great friend, Ellis Jenks and Roseanne Green and Charlie McConnell, who is also blind, along with Lucas. And the five of us flew to Tanzania. And we had done a lot of preparation back here in Australia, in Mount Kosciuszko in winter, and we did a lot of continue to do running, so we made sure our fitness levels were good, but we also were very much across what we wanted to get out of it.
Now, you mentioned there Sir Edmund Hillary. Mm. Now, I know that he's a great inspiration for you. So tell us about Sir Edmund, because you did actually end up meeting him.
I did. And it was such a wonderful moment. And a bit of a story, too, because back in 2006, I had a plan to travel to South America to trek up Aconcagua, the highest mountain in South America. And I was with a friend and we were training out of Auckland, but unfortunately the sponsorship fell through due to the untimely and sad death of Susan Fear, and a wonderful Australian climber.
Yes, we knew Sue very well.
Did
very
you?
Much
yeah.
missed. Yeah, yeah.
And it did affect our climb in the sense that the sponsorship, they got cold feet and backed out.
Mm.
But, you know, I'm philosophical about that in the sense that, well, it wasn't meant to happen, and who knows, if we had gone, and maybe something else could have happened. But what it meant on that trip to New Zealand where we were training in the middle of winter out west of Auckland, it gave me that opportunity to ring Sir Edmund Hillary. And I thought, no, you've probably got to put the phone down. But he said, Nick, come and visit me in my home.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
So myself and my friend, we went to his home and we sat in his sunroom with his wife, June. And I recall sitting down and he put his arm around my shoulders. And when I went to ask him a question, he said, Nick, wait. He said, I'm 80, I think it was 84, 85, whatever he said. But he said, I've answered questions all my life. I don't want to talk about my life. I want to hear about yours.
Mm.
And we sat for over an hour chatting away over a pot of tea and a packet of Tim Tams. And it was just one of those super moments. And people often say, well, why is he your hero? And I said, well, it wasn't so much that he was the first person along with Tenzin Norgay to summit Mount Everest. It was more that he went back and he was very much part of the Nepalese people. And he built schools and he built the clinic that still exists and the runway that people land these days on the side of the mountain. And I also mentioned that, and a lot of people don't know, that his first wife and daughter were killed in a plane crash.
Mm.
And he explained to me that after that terrible accident, He was very much affected, obviously, by that. And alcohol became part of his life for several years and it became quite a problem. And he realised he had to do something about it. And what that told me was that he was a human being. He wasn't a hero in the sense that everything was perfect, but he made mistakes, but he tried his best to rectify them and to become a person that could make a difference. And that's what I loved about Sir Edmund Hillary and his wife, June, who was a very supportive person of him. And he was he had great values. He was very opinionated, and you know, some people may have disagreed with him on certain things, but I think I loved how he had an opinion and he stuck by it.
Yeah, and I think the wonderful thing about him is that summiting Everest back in 1953 was really just the beginning for him, wasn't it?
It was.
It wasn't like the total sum of his achievements. He went on and achieved so many things in so many ways. But as you say, so humble and self-effacing. What a great role model, hey?
Oh, he was. And I promised him, I said, that I would do my best. I said, I'm not going to reach the summit. I'd love to, but financially, it's not going to be happening. And probably from a practical point of view, it's not feasible. But I said, I will definitely go to Mount Everest, which I did about 3 years later.
And what about the altitude? Were you affected by that in a bad way, or was it just something you were able to cope with?
Kilimanjaro, my dream was fulfilled, and I did feel the altitude, and when I did find it, then it became a bit of a nightmare rather than a dream.
Mm.
Because I remember on that last day on Kilimanjaro, Charlie, halfway through the morning, had extreme difficulty breathing and moving, and to the point where he had to return to Kibo Hut, where we'd stayed the previous night. Lucas made the hard call, but again, this all came into planning. We all agreed that Lucas, who had the experience and knowledge, he would be the one that would take and make any assessments. And he said, Charlie, it's over. He said, you're going back. And Charlie, to his credit, did not complain ever, not on that day or since. Mm. He went back with his local guide. And then I continued on with a bit of the added pressure of knowing that some people said, not directly to us but to others, that people who are blind shouldn't be doing it, they can't do it, they won't make it.
Mm.
And it gave me that drive to really push on. And it was a bit challenging, in particular that last day when you're going through scree, snow, and you've got the effects of altitude where you're not breathing so well. I've got a bit of a headache and a shortness of breath.
Mm.
And Lucas is really working one-on-one with me on this last day, trying to reach that summit. And we were pushing pretty hard to get there. And I remember we got there at 2:27 p.m. on the 27th of May.
Mm.
So, and just standing on the rooftop of Africa.
How wonderful.
You know, was, and Roseanne coming up. And she was the only woman in their little Blind Ambition group. And us men, I think we're all sitting on rocks, but Roseanne remained standing. And she described, she said, it's absolutely incredible, Nick. The clouds have parted. The sun is shining down onto and into the crater. And the snow is a brilliant blue. And I can see right across the plains of Africa. And those words and her energy, and I could sense she was bouncing up and down, even though, like, I was feeling absolutely out of it. They just, like, it just sunk into me. It's like, this is what it's all about. I love it. I'm here. And we've made it.
And, Nick, just how important is it that people do what your friend did and describe the scene to you?
Oh, it makes such a difference. And what it involves, and it can be a bit of a challenge, in that it does involve people stopping and just really taking in what's in front of them. And the feedback I get to, and I go to lots of art exhibitions, I love art.
Mm.
And even the art educators have said to me, Nick, you're really taking us to a different dimension, because we've never really had to stop and really look closely at something and put it into words.
Mm.
And they've all said, without exception, that they've loved that experience of looking and putting into words, often being questioned about. They'll tell me, then I say, yeah, but is the person smiling, or are they holding something, or tell me about this, tell me about that.
Mm.
And that's what I've loved knowing and feeling, that I've maybe extended people's lives as far as stretching them.
Yeah.
Discovering something about themselves that they may not have known before.
Yeah, so they have to, in order to put it into words, they've really got to look again at everything, really look deeply at any scene. So whilst they help you to sort of visualise the scene, it also helps them to kind of appreciate what's in front of them. I think it's a great partnership that you have with people when that happens.
Oh, it's wonderful. And usually my visits to art galleries, or, you know, the experience I had with Roseanne, but these things, they're pretty fleeting, in that even an exhibition, the concentration involved is around about an hour to an hour and a quarter, and that's as long as you can really hold that level of high concentration. Otherwise, you both get so exhausted. But you come out of there and think, oh, that was so fantastic.
Now, you've, in recent times, a couple of you, let's talk about some of your more recent adventures, because, you know, you've climbed your mountains, but you traversed the Simpson Desert a couple of years ago. And I have to say that the Simpson Desert is one of my favourite places in the world. Yeah. And when anyone asks me in the places that I've travelled in this job, what's my favourite, I always say the Simpson Desert at night is usually my answer. So when I read in your book, and we'll talk about your book in a little while, about your traverse of the Simpson Desert, and you were describing all of those scenes and those experiences and those sounds, I knew exactly what you were talking about. So tell us about how you would, you know, tackle something like walking across an Australian desert.
Yeah, well, again, I realised Lucas Trahee had been out in the Simpson Desert, so I connected up again with Lucas. We made sure that we put in place all the safety aspects because that's important. You don't want to just wander off without being properly prepared and having all things covered. So we covered all those things off again properly and also chatted about what I wanted to experience. So this time I said I wanted a smaller group. I wanted it to be as moments of solitude. And I invited my friend Vina from America that I met when she was on a visiting visa when she was in her early 20s. So we'd met when we were very young and we've remained great friends. So I said, I'm at a stage in my life where I really want my closest friend to be there. So she came along, she flew to Australia. I was introduced to Sarah Delaney, a wonderful expert in outdoor activities.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew to Birdsville. We were driven, I think it was about a 7-hour drive out to Popel's Corner. And there we were dropped off and we set off, the three of us. Now, before your listeners start to think, well, Nick, you're some sort of hero, I got in really early. I said, you know what, I barred sleeping in the middle. I thought, if a big camel comes along, I'm safest in the middle. So I'm not brave, I'm a coward. But that feeling of walking, the three of us, in such an isolated area where we knew that the chance of coming across anyone else was almost zero. And to be able to look at things that other people probably would never or are unlikely to see unless you make that effort. To feel the footprints of, say, an emu or a kangaroo or a dingo in the sand. To pick up the different things that were discovered. And people might sort of shun, but I remember Sarah saying, Nick, put your hand flat. And then she put a dead scorpion in my hand and I could feel it. And it's like, wow, no, I loved it. I mean, I won't have probably that opportunity ever again. To feel the flowers and to have them described and to taste the berries that Sarah found and knew that we could safely eat. One of the absolute highlights was discovering the Aboriginal artifacts that were there, and who knows, it could be 1,000, could be 10,000, 30,000 years ago, to feel them. And of course we were very strict that we put them back exactly where they were lying. It was also my opportunity to have some moments of spirituality, to reflect on my life, just sit down and just not have anything interrupting. So I had no phone, no technology. I knew that someone was going to call out and say, it's dinner time, or can you do this or do that? That was an extreme highlight for me in the Simpson Desert.
And did you sleep out under the stars?
Oh, we did. No tents, of course, because we were carrying our own food and water. We just slept on a mat on the ground, under the stars, which they described to me. At least one or two nights we had dingoes howling, and that was wonderful. And one morning I remember waking up and they described how during the night a dingo and its pup had walked within metres of our camp. They could see the footprints in the sand. And I thought, wow, you know, how close to nature are we? Just one of those tremendous moments.
Now, last year you decided that you were going to walk across a lake. And you went down to South Australia and did a traverse of Lake Eyre. So how did that come about? Where did that idea come from?
Well, I love the Simpson Desert, but I when I came back, I sensed that I needed more solitude. So I spoke with Lucas and I said, what could I do that would really take me into solitude? So he said, well, you could do a crossing of what they call Island Lagoon, which is in South Australia. And he said, it's the chances of rain is almost zero. And he travelled out there to just check it all over, which he did so thoroughly with his son, and so appreciative. Now, this is a very remote place and you need a special vehicle. It's very challenging to even drive down using your vehicle to get near the lagoon. So we put everything in place, and I would travel with Sarah and a great friend of hers, Monique, and we drove the 1,600 and umpteen kilometres out to Island Lagoon, and we did all the proper preparation. And the night before, Sarah's playing guitar, and we had a fire there burning, and we had a beautiful dinner prepared by Monique and Sarah mostly, and me a little bit. And then, boom, the thunderstorm hit.
Oh, wow. A very rare event, no doubt.
And it dumped 20 mils onto the lake. And so Sarah was back in communication with Lucas, and we're talking about it. And the thing is, you just don't know what it's like out there. So we delayed it 2 days. But it came to the point, like, no, we're just going to walk down through the narrows, which is about 6 kilometres, down to the lagoon where I was planning to cross and see what it's like. And we get down there and Sarah says, you won't believe it, it's dry. It looks dry. So I don't know what it's like beyond here.
Mm.
And I said, well, no, I'm going to do it. So within an hour, I was all ready to go. And I said goodbye to Sarah and Monique. And with great confidence and adulation, I set off. And I think it was 1.8 k's in, I came across water. So it's ankle deep, and it's like, oh my goodness. Now this is a bit of a shock to the system. And I had that momentary, oh no, don't say this is going to undermine my whole thing. We had a two-way radios that I connected with Sarah and Monique, and I said what was happening. And they said, Nick, just keep going. Just don't be fazed by it. And by 5 p.m., what we will do, using our technology, we will guide you off the lake so that you can find dry sand to sleep on. So they did that, and I walked off the lake, and they said, you'll know when you're off the lake, it'll become dry and you'll find vegetation. So I found a plant or two, and I realised, yep, I'm off the lake. And I set up my camp for the first night, and just rolling my mat out and preparing my meal. And we discovered these wonderful meals by adding some water. It would set off a sequence of things that would heat up the meal. So I had a beautiful hot meal just by adding water to the contents. And there I spent that night. And then the following morning, I then walked back onto the lake. And that would be a very challenging day because the water became deeper. At times, it got to my knee. And it meant that, well, I felt I couldn't take my backpack off. So I actually walked for 8 hours with my very heavy backpack. And there were moments through that day where our tracking device I wouldn't say it wasn't working, but temporarily it wasn't showing where I was. But again, Monique was very calm and she said, look, I'm not sure where you are, but you know what, you just keep heading this direction, I'll pick you up. And several hours later she did, and then we were able to say, okay, you know, you drifted a bit south, we think you should go north, a bit more northerly. And eventually about 4:30 p.m., I found a dry spot on this amazing island in the middle of the lagoon, and that's where I'd spend my second night on my mat. And I was totally exhausted that night, a little bit delirious. I'd made the mistake of not drinking enough and not eating enough, so that was a bit of a learning curve for me and maybe others in the future. But again, it was just wonderful. And I remember waking up in the middle of the night and just total silence and just the air around me. And I'd planned this in advance. I had my phone with me, obviously have no reception, but I listened to my favourite book, Great Expectations by Charles Dickens. And I thought, you know what, I don't think Charles Dickens would ever anticipated the reading of one of his books in such an isolate place in Australia.
I'm sure he went. And I think what I probably didn't point out at the beginning of that this was a solo trek across this salt lake in South
That's
Australia.
Right.
You were actually going to be on your own. You
on
wouldn't
my own.
Have anyone around you, nobody to hold on to or nobody to tell you what was coming up. And
loved
solo
it.
Trek for three
I
days.
Absolutely loved it. And what am I too, and hopefully you'll be able to hear this, I have my talking compass that I used.
Mm.
And I'll just, not sure if it's going to pick it up. It's saying northwest.
Mm.
North, east, northwest,
southeast, east.
And that's the device that I used, along with a braille compass.
Mm.
And the combination of those two devices enabled me to have a greater control over what was happening.
Mm.
And again, like that solo trek was the right thing at the right time in my life at my age.
Mm. And did you have, so you had some kind of positioning device on you so that your team could track you at any particular time, but it wasn't working too well all the time?
Yeah, we had the tracking device and it wasn't working absolutely all the time, but eventually it did pick up. And I was never at risk. I never felt, I was a little bit frustrated, I think, once or twice. But I knew, too, that the safety mechanism, we had another device that I had to update every 24 hours, and it was a device that would enable people to find me in the event of something going terribly wrong. But I also understood, and Sarah explained to me very clearly, that in the event of something happening, some terrible health issue, that the chances of getting out of there were quite remote, in the sense that you can't drive a vehicle out there. It would literally have to be a helicopter rescue.
Mm.
And it was important for me to understand that to walk, we'd have to walk out of there, basically.
It's very remote, that part of the world. And, of course, those lakes just... Is it part of Lake Eyre, or it's just another salt lake in that area?
It's in that area, and we were planning Lake Eyre. The problem we had was that Lucas, when he did his reconnaissance, said Lake Eyre is just too wet.
Mm.
Even before we got there, it was too much water.
Mm.
So it's a little bit, not a regret, but it's just one of those things that, as much as I wanted to do Lake Eyre, it just wasn't feasible.
And Nick, do you have a bucket list of things that you want to do? Tell us about some things you'd like to do.
I think one of the things I need to do is, and this might sound a bit contrary to what people might be thinking, and I'm starting to do it pretty well, and that is to realise I am getting older. And that is to be realistic about what is possible, and also discovering other things that will add value to my life. And that's why I wrote my book 2 years ago, and I continue to do lots of writing. And writing has become such an important part of my life, because it's something that I can do, hopefully, for the next 20 years or the years I have remaining in my life, that I can actually continue to do it. So my bucket list is to continue to find the things that can add value to my life, and that is writing, and I very much love doing that, and I encourage everyone, even if it's never published, publication is not that relevant, but to write and to for your own expression, and maybe it might be shared by close family or friends, and now or into the future. It might be future generations. I find my children, they don't necessarily want to read about my word because they're so busy doing their own things. But it might be future generations of my family that say, you know what, no, my grandfather, my great-great-grandfather did this or did that, and here's his experiences. Mm-hmm. So that's what I look at. And I love reading. I probably read 2 books a week. Mm. Now, I'm often through the night reading my books and getting up, and rather than listening to the terrible news that's often on TV and radio, I think, you know, I don't really need to know too much about that. Mm. I'm going to read a book and read about things that enhance my life.
Well, look, the book is called The Many Ways of Seeing, written by Nick Gleason with Peter Bishop, who's your writing mentor. I'm almost finished the book, started reading it this week. You do write very beautifully.
Thank you.
You write about your life in a way that really will open people's eyes actually to how it is to be blind. And you speak about all of the people that mean so much to you in your life with such great love, that I really do believe you've got a true gift for writing. And I would recommend anybody to read this book to get an insight what it's like to be a blind person and what it's like to actually overcome many of the obstacles that are put in the way of people with any kind of disability. And that sort of grit and spirit that you have, Nick, is so inspirational and comes through beautifully in the book. And I can see that, you know, there would be a lot of writing ahead of you.
Thank you, Chrissy. And I look back and I look back to when I received the Spirit of Adventure Award back in 2002. And what it meant to me, I remember very clearly, it was a morning at the zoo that I received that wonderful medallion and recognition. And then quite shock and surprise, I never thought, no, an ordinary person, I say that literally, an ordinary person could really start to do the things that were important to me. And as an ordinary person, I encourage all the millions of other ordinary people to just do what is important to you in your life, and your goals will be completely different to mine, but equally as important, and probably not as stupid and ridiculous as all the adventures I've done. You probably have far more wise and sane, but no matter what they are, no matter how small or large, long as they're important to you, that is the main thing.
I think it's a very, very good message to send out there. And look, I think a story for Australian Geographic might be in the pipeline. What do you reckon, Nick? What are you doing in the next couple of months?
Let's chat.
Anyway, look, I would say you may have lost your sight, Nick Gleason, but you haven't lost your vision. You are a true inspiration and a wonderful role model for anyone in any walk of life, no matter what. And it's been my absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Day and also to have your beautiful dog Unity in the room with us. Not a peep out of Unity. Definitely got a big future in podcasting.
Very well behaved.
But it's just been a wonderful experience to meet you and to hear about your adventures and your amazing life. Thank you so much, Nick Gleason.
My pleasure.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with Nick Gleason. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email. podcast@australiangeographic.com. Or find us on Instagram @Australian Geographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find special offers for our listeners, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait and go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. Until next time.